Well, hello and welcome back to the FRCS Eurocast. I'm Sophia Cashman. I'm a fellow at Nottingham, finally, joined with my now colleague and co-host.
Hi, Sophia. Harry Rattan, urologist from Nottingham. And yeah, it seems like it's been an interminable wait, but we've finally managed to drag you over to Nottingham.
The Midlands, or the North, as everyone in Cambridge is calling
the
it.
The North, yeah. Come on. We've got a proper Northerner on this evening, which we'll come to in a minute. But look, we've been off air a bit, mainly because I've been skiving off. I've been to AUA in Chicago, which was fabulous, and you've been working too hard in Nottingham to do anything else. Is that right, Sophia?
Of course, yeah. Absolute slave labour there.
Absolutely. We're back on air, and thank you all for your continued feedback. And I've had a couple of other nice emails, and actually a couple of clinical questions. So I'll for those of you that emailed the questions, I'll track down our former guests and put them to them at some point. I think there was a question on PUJ for Kim that was quite complicated, actually, so I think I am going to refer that one to Kim.
Yeah, not us.
Yeah, not us. We're just the entertainment. Thankfully, we've got some proper brains on. And on that note, that was a brilliant link, wasn't it, Sophia? So I'll let you introduce tonight's special
no,
guest.
No, not really. We'll smooth it over. So I'm delighted to say today we are joined by Professor Chris Harding from the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle, who is chair of the EAU Female LUTS Guidelines Panel, and very kindly agreed to join us today to talk about recurrent urinary tract infections. So thank you in advance for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to participate.
I think, Sophia, have you got the case that we're going to discuss today?
I have. So, as always, we'll start with a five-star scenario. Today we'll talk about a 58-year-old lady who was referred to your clinic with recurrent urinary tract infections. The GP reports she's had 5 lab-confirmed infections over the past 12 months. The patient's a type 2 diabetic on metformin and postmenopausal. How would you approach this type of patient in your clinic?
So I'd just start with the basics. So there's some more aspects of the history that I'd want to bring out. You said this lady is getting culture-proven UTIs, so that's kind of the first box ticked in terms of diagnostics, because very often you get someone presenting with episodic lower urinary tract symptoms suggestive of recurrent UTIs, but negative test results, and that's probably a fault of the tests rather than anything else. So I think, you know, the diagnosis of recurrent UTIs doesn't appear to be in doubt. We are all now pretty much agreed on a standard definition of recurrent, which is 3 episodes in 12 months or 2 in 6 months. So she satisfies that criteria. The type 2 diabetes is obviously something we should be bearing in mind for a number of reasons. Firstly, the effect on her immune system that it might have, and secondly, considering potential prophylactic agents and specifically things like D-mannose, which is a sugar, which you have to be a bit careful about in diabetics. And the fact that she's postmenopausal obviously has been highlighted in the history already, so that kind of opens the door to some topical hormonal prophylaxis. But I think if you haven't got such an obvious case like this, you need to try and get an idea of whether this is, you know, an infective cystitis or an episodic cystitis for other reasons, such as inflammatory. And I think one of the key things that I look at is patient's previous response to antibiotics and whether or not it's been definite, it's been, you know, quick, and whether it's been reproducible in the past. So in terms of developing what we know so far, I'd probably want to know things like, are there any obvious trigger factors? What did those cultures show? You know, is it always an E. coli? As you know, if you're playing probabilities, it probably will be E. coli. Is there anything to suggest that this might be complicated rather than uncomplicated urinary tract infections? And by that, I mean whether or not there's any structural or functional abnormalities of the urinary tract. So I think once we've taken the history and established those factors, I'd obviously do a clinical examination and look for anything that might predispose. So things you can pick up on a simple examination would be, a relatively asymptomatic high residual if you felt a palpable bladder, things like urethral diverticular or any obvious, pelvic organ prolapse signs when you did a vaginal examination. So I'd just really start with the basics, and I wouldn't want to be overcomplicating things. And then I think we kind of got to think a little bit about investigations. And this is where it starts to get a little bit contentious. So there was something in the BJUI last summer in their Guideline of Guidelines series, and it looked specifically at UTIs. And one of the aspects this manuscript looked at was the recommendations in terms of investigations. So I think we all know that the diagnostic yield of cystoscopy and upper tract imaging is really low in patients with recurrent uncomplicated urinary tract infection. But in my unit, this woman would get a renal tract ultrasound scan and a flexible cystoscopy. Now, you may argue that that's not evidence-based, but in my UTI clinic, I would say we pick up probably between 5 and 10 bladder tumours a year. We pick up numerous asymptomatic renal stones. And that's, these are other things that you might be talking about in due course if your simple measures are not effective.
Is there anyone in particular in your unit that would not get those? Like, is there anyone that you wouldn't, or is it all comers get kind of upper and lower tract, like, visualised?
No, I don't think I'd cystoscope women under 40. Mm-hmm. But I would probably do an ultrasound scan on most, well, if not all, patients with recurrent UTIs. And you're just looking for things that would include a post void scan as well. So, and that helps me classify, is this a complicated or uncomplicated UTI, because I vary my treatment of the acute exacerbations according to that. Okay. So specifically with regards to antibiotic duration, anyone with a complicated urinary tract infection certainly gets 7 to 10 days mm-hmm. of antibiotic. And this is to treat an acute episode rather than anything preventative. Whereas if I think patients with uncomplicated, they would get between 3 and 5 days.
And just to go back slightly, when you the people that have cultures that are negative, if they do respond to antibiotics symptomatically, would you still kind of manage them as recurrent UTIs?
Yeah, I would. With the trial we recently published, the primary outcome was a clinical definition of urinary tract infection, which was uh-huh. the existence of symptoms which suggested UTI and the prescription of an appropriate antibiotic. And that was all done by independent healthcare professionals, so there was no bias from the trial team.
Yeah.
But what we found, we also took cultures, obviously, and we got the patients to send us samples of their urines to our central lab, so they were all analysed in the same way, so there was no differentiation there. And what we found is literally it was about half of all antibiotic-treated episodes of suggestive symptoms, i.e. clinical UTIs, only about half of them were accompanied by a positive urine culture. So I think, for that reason, I do look at response to antibiotics as a pretty strong predictor of whether or not this is an infective problem or it isn't.
Great. So if hypothetically, if you hadn't found anything that would complicate things, there was no suspicious features on an ultrasound and your exam didn't show anything of concern, you said you don't have a standard, do you have an algorithm you use to manage these, or a stepwise approach, or is it all individualized?
No, I mean, I think there's some broad steps, aren't they? So there's some basic measures patients can take. So they should all, by the time they get to me, they've normally done a lot of this, but I think, with the sort of index patient, you should look at voiding habits. You should look at fluid intake. There's an RCT, which is published in one of, I think, the JAMA spin-off journals from a couple of years back, which looked at women who were getting recurrent UTIs and drinking less than 1.5 litres a day. And they were randomized to no intervention or an additional 1.5 litres of fluid intake. And that reduced the UTI incidence by about 50%. So I think, you know, that there are, and everyone thinks they drink enough. But I think you've got to look at how much they're drinking, and specifically also look at their voiding habits. So, you know, it's quite important for women with recurrent urinary tract infections to void frequently, and I think that's something that's often a bit underplayed. You know, and clinicians sometimes tend to dive in with, oh, well, what can we give them in terms of prophylaxis and what's the RCT tell us and all the rest of it. But actually some basic advice I think is probably quite pertinent. So I would just start with that.
Do you
That's
mind
right.
what they drink? Does it is it is water best, or is there anything that they can drink specifically to
Well, I
help?
mean, the evidence points towards water. So that, you know, that's where it lies. But you know, I think they can drink pretty much whatever they like. I mean, you know, it's, you've got to bear in mind that the other things people might drink, such as tea or coffee, they'll have chemicals within them that will stimulate the bladder and perhaps even inflame it. You know, concentrated fruit juices, they're probably not a great idea because they can also irritate the bladder as well. So I think I probably would advise water, but I think, you know, if there's some people who could just really don't like the taste of water, and so they would drink like a weak cordial of something, but as long as it's not too acidic, then I think that's not unreasonable.
Great.
So then I think what I do next is move on to kind of prophylaxis, and I break it down into kind of three areas. So one would be non-antibiotic options. The other one, I would have a discussion about daily antibiotics, and then I'd talk about other things that I don't use very commonly, such as, you know, well, they call it immunoactive prophylaxis. A lot of people call them vaccines. That they're not true vaccines, but they are immunoactive, and for some reason they've never really penetrated UK practice. I think they use much more frequently in Europe, and you know, they do have some good evidence to support their use. And then I would talk about things like intravesical treatments as well, which I think I don't tend to reserve as a kind of second line. So really I kind of just go through, you know, it's almost like giving the patients a menu rather than being prescriptive and telling them what they should use, because there are some patients who are really, really hell-bent on, well, there's only antibiotics make me better, and they really want to try antibiotic prophylaxis, where there are others who really understand the potential risks of antibiotic prophylaxis and want to explore the evidence behind the other agents.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you ever have a group of patients that you kind of know from the get-go are not going to respond to anything other than antibiotics?
No, I don't think so. I don't think
So.
I don't think I can identify anything that's gonna, I mean, I don't know who's gonna respond to what. So
Fine.
it's
So
a
they
bit
really
of,
will pick whatever kind
yeah,
of symptom.
I think so. And I think you look at sort of frequency of infections. If I really want to get a hold of very frequent recurrent UTIs, then I would possibly favor antibiotic prophylaxis, because I think they've got the strongest evidence base to support their use. So I think, yeah, in answer to your question, if they were very, you know, if I had a patient who was getting monthly UTIs, then I'd probably talk to them about, I mean, I'd talk to them about everything, but I'd possibly explain that antibiotics are kind of the most evidence-based treatment in terms of UTI prevention.
Right. And so would you mind just going through your kind of non-antibiotic category?
Yeah, okay. So I talked to them about cranberry. A lot of them ask me about cranberry products. And I tell them that the evidence has sort of changed quite a lot, even in my time in urology. So when I was first a urology trainee, the Cochrane Review said that cranberry products were useful in terms of UTI prevention. They then updated the Cochrane Review, which said it probably wasn't superior to placebo or water. And then we've had, since the last Cochrane update, we've had a few different studies coming through, some a bit contradictory. I think the EAU stance on it is that they may be protective, but the efficacy is not quite clear. But I think the kind of the plus point for cranberry is the benefit to harm ratio, which is very, very favorable indeed. And I think the EU guidelines do mention that. They talk about, you know, it may be worth a try in terms of UTI prevention. But the problem I have with cranberry is there's no real guidance on what's the optimum preparation. Should it be extract, juice, whatever? How long should you take it? How much should you take? And I don't really think there's been any good evidence to help clinicians. So you know, I start with that and let them, you know, make a decision with regards to that.
The other thing that a lot of people recommend is D-mannose supplementation. So is there much evidence behind that?
So there's one really good trial that I like, and I think the first author is Krancheck, and I think it's a really good RCT. The only issue I have with it is the primary outcome wasn't quite right, which was time to UTI. So basically, the issue with time to UTI is that, you know, you might within the first 6 weeks of any therapy get the one and only UTI you're going to get in 12 months. But according to that kind of analysis, you're going to be deemed a treatment failure. Whereas, you know, if to qualify for these trials, you have to have recurrent UTIs, which is defined on frequency. So therefore, any outcome measure in my eyes should also be defined on frequency. But the RCT for D-mannose that I've mentioned actually talks about a reduction of about 70-75%, I think, in terms of UTI frequency. And it was a three-arm RCT. It was nitrofurantoin daily, D-mannose, and no prophylaxis. And basically, the D-mannose and the daily nitrofurantoin were almost equivalent. At I think it was 6 months was the trial duration. But, you know, you're talking about big levels of reduction, kind of 75-80%. So you know, it's certainly, I think, in this trial was proven to be effective and safe. But then there's other trials where the results are not as good. But I'm certainly a fan of D-mannose. I've got lots of patients who use it. I think the issue is that, you know, we don't prescribe it. They have to go and source it themselves. And then do you know what kind of, you know, D-mannose they're buying and where they're buying it from? But what I do tell them is that in the trials, a dose of 1 gram twice daily was the one that stood up against the daily antibiotics. So, yeah.
Do you use D-mannose for people that get non-E. coli UTIs?
I think it would be better served for, because obviously the way D-mannose is supposed to work is to kind of competitively be like a competitive antagonist to the a subunit on the tail of the E. coli fimbriae. And I mean, you know, I suppose you could call it, there's another class of UTI preventive agents called FIMH antagonists. Mm-hmm. And I think basically it sits on the tail of the E. coli. It then stops the first kind of stage in the process of urinary tract infection, which is adhesion to the mannosylated residues on the urothelium. So if the E. coli can't stick, then, you know, there's only one fate, and that's it will be voided. So I think, you know, it may be an area of development in the future, the FIMH antagonist, whether there's something that's even better than D-mannose, who knows. But the evidence, I think, is reasonable.
And what's your view on it with diabetics?
I think you have to be careful. I think, you know, it is a sugar, but at doses of 1 gram of D-mannose twice a day, you very rarely upset diabetic control.
Fine.
But because they're, you see, because they're sourcing it themselves, you don't know what they're taking, how much. You know, I mean, I've had patients tell me they're taking, you know, 8 grams of D-mannose a day, and I think that would be a worry if they were diabetic.
Yeah.
So that's why it's important to mention the dose.
I guess the next big topic then is methenamine as a non-antibiotic prophylactic.
The thing about methenamine is we had been using it in the UTI clinic in Newcastle for a long time, and we knew it was going to be effective. What we didn't know is how effective was it going to be relative to daily antibiotics. So I always wanted to do the trial and have the comparator as daily antibiotics, because I thought, actually, if you compare it to what is still, I suppose, the gold standard, then you know exactly where you stand with this, with any treatment, if you compare it to a current gold standard. So with Alta, there was no placebo arm, and I think that highlights another difficulty in UTI research when you're doing placebo-controlled trials. If patients are getting regular urinary tract infections and having all the symptoms that go with it, they don't really want to take a 50-50 chance of not getting an active treatment in a research trial. So that was like one of the things that I think in Alta made recruitment really easy, because you know, whichever arm you were randomized to, you were going to get an active treatment. There was no placebo control. But we recruited 240 women in Alta, and on average at the start, they were getting about 7 UTIs a year. So this is really like a UTI every 6 or 8 weeks. And our focus group work prior to the trial had just told us exactly how awful UTIs were for patients in terms of affecting their quality of life, affecting their ability to be, you know, part of their family, to be a mum, a granny or whatever, affecting their ability to go to work. So we talked to the focus groups about this trial, and then they then threw us a massive banana skin, which is that we talked about the inferiority margin. So we said we want to do this trial. One arm will be antibiotics, the other arm will be non-antibiotics, and we want to show that they're roughly equivalent in terms of UTI prevention. And we asked the patients what they would consider non-equivalence to look like. And they said, well, if it was just one more UTI in a 12-month period, then that would be not equivalent to us, because, you know, and I thought, oh my God, where have they set the bar? So our non-inferiority margin was a single UTI, and we, you know, I mean, I didn't sleep for a long time worried about whether or not we'd actually get that close to. But anyway, what the results showed is that you know, the difference between UTI rate in the methenamine group and the antibiotic group did fall at less than one UTI. It was actually 0.5 UTIs. So it was one UTI every 2 years difference. So antibiotics, they did numerically outperform, but in terms of our ability to declare methenamine not inferior, it fell within the limit. And you know, we took patients with methenamine. They averaged 7 UTIs at trial entry, and during the 12 months of treatment, the mean UTI rate was 1.4. So that's a really good reduction in terms of urinary tract infection frequency. What we also found in Alta is that during the treatment period, the resistance to of E. coli, which we cultured from perianal swabs. So we got the patients to self-swab, and then we plated it out, looked at the E. coli, looked at their resistance patterns. And during treatment, the resistance was higher in those who were taking daily antibiotics. It didn't quite reach statistical significance. The p-value was 0.052, so it was really, really close. But it was certainly numerically higher in those who were taking daily antibiotics. And that's, you know, the kind of implicit advantage in methenamine. So when you talk about methenamine, some people know how it works, but you have to explain it's more of an antiseptic rather than an antibiotic. It doesn't specifically target a certain bacteria, although I think it does work best on recurrent E. coli UTIs. And it's broken down by hydrolysis in the distal tubule of the kidney. And the active component of methenamine is formaldehyde. So basically, the patients who know this talk about the safety of formaldehyde, because formaldehyde is classified
as a carcinogen.
Yeah. So if you look, there's been a couple of European safety reviews that comment on the concentrations of methenamine found the concentration of methenamine in medical use. And there's no evidence to suggest. And, you know, I talked a lot to the late James Maloney about this, because, you know, we were both big methenamine users, and I still am. And, you know, and all of the, there's no evidence to suggest that there's any link between urinary tract cancers or indeed any other cancers and methenamine use. But of course, I've now got hundreds and hundreds of little urine ice cubes with various levels of formaldehyde in them. And so that,
for the next study.
Well, this is what we're doing now as a follow-on from ALTA. We're looking at whether or not, you know, there's the levels of formaldehyde in the urines of these patients is enough to be bactericidal. So,
do you find it's generally well tolerated?
Yeah, I mean, there. If you look at the side effect profile of antibiotics versus methenamine in the trial, it was pretty much equal, you know, in terms of both the severity and the type of side effects. I think sometimes what you do see with methenamine is that it can cause kind of upper GI symptoms, like, you know, maybe dyspepsia and things like that. But there are things you can do for that. So, you know, there are these gelatin capsules you can use to wrap up your methenamine. I mean, the tablets are big enough anyway, but
you coat them in jelly.
Yeah, you do. And that delays their kind of absorption until sort of, you know, I think the kind of small bowel rather than the stomach, and that helps patients. Yeah. But certainly those side effects were no different in the trial compared to daily antibiotics.
And do you give it with vitamin C?
The one regret I have about ALTA, and I was delighted with ALTA. It was one of the best pieces of research we've ever done. But my big regret was I didn't include an arm with vitamin C addition. But when I talk to nephrologists, you know, about acidifying urine, they just laugh at me. You know, they don't think there's any real reliable way of acidifying most patients' urine. So, you know, I don't know whether vitamin C will be. I mean, I do tell people that methenamine works best in acid urine, but the best piece of advice you can give them around urinary pH is not to take cystitis relief sachets, which of course are urinary alkalizing agents, at the same time as methenamine, because you may as well not bother. But with regards to urinary acidification, I mean, we have applied for some funding to look specifically at this issue, so hopefully we'll be able to clarify that. But I think for the moment, I just tell patients that there's, you know, what the theory is, and that vitamin C may increase the effectiveness of the methenamine.
And can I ask you about vaginal estrogens?
Yeah, you definitely can.
So, thanks. Firstly, do you believe they have a role in those that are premenopausal?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think, I mean, if you look at the evidence it will support their use in postmenopausal women quite rightly. And of course, you know, the idea is that they create vaginal conditions that are conducive to lactobacilli colonization rather than E. coli or any uropathogenic organism. And there's been some quite elegant work done with PCRs looking at whether or not vaginal estrogen actually does cause lactobacilli colonization or does facilitate lactobacilli colonization of the vagina. And the idea is that it does. You know, and this is, again, something else with good evidence to support its use. So in the Cochrane review that exists on the subject, they make a couple of interesting points. The first one is that in some studies the risk reduction is comparative to that of antibiotics, although I have to say that in any comparative trial of vaginal estrogen and antibiotics, vaginal estrogen has always come off worse, so I don't think it's perhaps as good. The second thing is that they do talk about the difference in terms of UTI prevention between vaginal preparations of estrogen versus things like oral HRT. So I think the evidence would suggest that the vaginal route is best, and the reason for that is perhaps linked to estrogen's role in the innate immune system. So what we've shown in the lab in Newcastle is that, you know, application of estrogen to vaginal epithelium increases the concentration of these small proteins called antimicrobial peptides, which chief function is to just smash holes into cell walls of E. coli. And we think it might be some kind of local effect that enhances the innate immune response. So that may explain why perhaps oral HRT. Now, I've talked to various different authorities about this quite a lot, and One of them is Louise Newsome, who's basically an expert in menopause medicine. And she thinks that the more modern HRT preparations are UTI protective. So there is a study planned to look at that, because a lot of the studies that are included in the meta-analyses and the systematic reviews, they're quite old. But, you know, we've got an up-to-date systematic review. I mean, Bhaskar Samani and his group in Southampton are just prolific in producing these systematic reviews in this topic area. And one of them was looking at topical estrogen. And again, that found much the same as the Cochrane review, in that, you know, vaginal estrogen was best. And in terms of UTI reduction, it was quite variable between, say, something as high as 75% down to maybe a 30 or 40% reduction.
And would those on oral HRT be precluded from vaginal estrogens, or can you add in?
No, you can add it in. I mean, you don't absorb any of this stuff. And I mean, you know, I've even got oncologists who are happy for me to use this in their breast cancer patients, because they...
I was just going to ask that, because I think that's quite a common group that gets recurrent UTIs, isn't it? The ladies who've had...
Yeah,
breast cancer,
yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Maybe on anti-estrogen therapy. And I have to say, I always write to them and check, and they very rarely say that we shouldn't give vaginal estrogen. So presumably the bioavailability is very low in terms of the systemic concentration.
Yeah, virtually nil. I mean, you know, and that kind of, you know, I think it's been a bit of a seed change in terms of attitude towards it. Because, you know, I used to get oncologists telling me off for giving patients with a history of breast cancer topical estrogen, but now they encourage it. So I think the pharmacokinetics of the drug will...
So, sorry, Sophia, do you have any preference regarding pessaries versus estrogen cream?
Yeah, so I use Vagifem pessaries. And I've always used them. You used to get a higher dose, but they stopped making the higher dose. And the way I use them is I ask women to insert a pessary daily for 2 weeks, and then twice a week as maintenance. And I find it very effective. And the one group that I think it's really effective in, and you asked Sophia about premenopausal, is those who are getting ISC related infections, so almost like they're inoculating their vaginal flora into their bladder. So I concentrate on the vaginal flora to try and modulate that, and I think vaginal estrogen is particularly effective in that group.
In any age category.
Yeah, because of the non-absorption, I don't worry too much about what age they are.
Have you got anything else in your kind of non-antibiotic armory that you use?
So I suppose then you're moving on to like intravesical treatments. So that, you know, they fall broadly into two arms. One would be an antibiotic, such as gentamicin, I think a lot of people are using. And then the others are the kind of the myriad of gag replacement preparations that are out there. I think the best evidence is for UTI prevention surrounds the kind of the chondroitin and hyaluronate mixture. And I think if you look at kind of systematic reviews, they all talk about the high levels of bias that might be associated with a lot of the studies surrounding intravesical therapy. But they do suggest that actually the UTI reduction is higher with intravesical gag replacement than it is with intravesical antibiotics. But that's not what I see clinically. So I think because of the existing evidence base in this area, the NIHR put out a commission call recently to look at studies that would evaluate the efficacy of intravesical treatments. And one of the studies we've pitched to them is a direct comparative study between intravesical gag replacement versus intravesical antibiotics. But I tend to reserve these treatments for those patients who have been refractory to other things. Apart from patients who are having complicated UTIs that have to self-catheterize anyway. So what I don't want to do is throw, you know, catheterization in, because in terms of, you know, the regimes for these things, they're not very well defined. I mean, I know in Bristol they use daily intravesical gentamicin, whereas in Newcastle we tend to use it just once a week. So there is quite a difference between the regimes. And none of these have been established with high quality trials. So that's something that certainly needs doing.
And how much do you give? What's your preparation?
So we give 80 milligrams of gentamicin and we dissolve that in about 40 mils of saline. And we get the patients to put it in and hold it for as long as they can. So the ideal thing is that, you know, they pop the catheter in last thing at night, put the 80, you know, empty their bladders, put the 40 mils of gentamicin solution in and go to sleep. And that's really got me out of trouble quite a lot in terms of really very refractory UTIs.
And do you ever measure gent levels? Or
yeah,
anything?
So we did. So in order for me to get it through our local drugs and therapeutics committee, I had to do renal function and gent levels on all patients for the first 6 months that we used it, and I never ever once had a detectable gentamicin level. So this is the, and if you think it with an intact urothelium, you shouldn't, should you? You know, you don't absorb things from the bladder. But you know, it's not just about the gentamicin absorption, but what the beauty of this is, it doesn't change the gut flora. So all of the, you know, I'll talk about antibiotics in a second, systemic antibiotics, but actually, if you give it intravesically, it shouldn't alter, you know, the rectal reservoir, it shouldn't alter the vaginal reservoir, and therefore, I think that's a real big advantage.
Did you notice any, or have you come across any gentamicin resistance brewing after having this?
Not after this, no. I mean, I mean, we are globally seeing an increase in resistance rates. Yeah. I've seen some very nasty organisms. I don't know whether COVID had anything to do with it, but it just seems to be a really big change after COVID that I'm getting much more multi-resistant, and I don't know whether that's because antibiotic use might have gone up because it wasn't dependent on laboratory cultures for any infection. I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating here, but you know, my personal view is that post-COVID you're seeing more Klebsiella and you're seeing more multi-resistant bacteria.
Are you seeing more fungal infections as well?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I still think they're few and far between. I mean, one has to look for them, obviously, but I still think they're fairly few and far between.
Apart from in stone patients where we see them all the time.
Or immunocompromised.
Absolutely. It's probably a topic for another day. So just to be clear on this intravesical antibiotics then, Chris, is that something you use during the active phase of an infection? Then, if they've been refractory,
I tend to use it as prophylaxis. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't use it for an isolated cystitis. Obviously, it would be no good for an upper tract infection, but I don't tend to use it as treatment. I have to say it's more prevention. I don't know whether, like, you know, if you think about, we're only giving 80 milligrams in 40 mils, it's not a high concentration. You know, if you give it over time, then the infection frequency reduces. And I've had some great results from, you know, patients who I was really concerned about. And I mean, you know, there are patients who you just cannot eradicate their UTIs. And it's just about making them as infrequent and lessening the severity of them. So it's an option, but it's not one I go to anywhere near first line. But I do at first consultation just like to lay everything out so that the patient, you know, won't be surprised if I say at the next consultation, well, right, we're now going to, you know, stick this plastic tube in your bladder and give you all kinds of things to try and prevent the UTIs.
And with your installations, with Ialuril or whatever your installation of choice, do you give an induction course, then maintenance?
Yeah.
How long do you maintain
so we give them once a week for 6 weeks and then we evaluate, and most patients would need a further six installations at weekly intervals, and then I think after 3 months we start to taper it a bit, so we would go from once a week to once a fortnight. I try and individualize that, to be honest with you, because I think, you know, every case is slightly different, and I wouldn't want to be too prescriptive. And a lot of patients, when they've had their first 3 months of being UTI free for a long period, they're very reticent. Yeah, exactly. So you just basically, whereas, you know, there's an obvious driver to stop things like prophylactic antibiotics because of resistance and things like that. But actually, you know, when you get a patient who says, well, look, the catheterization doesn't bother me and the treatment doesn't appear to be having any side effects, why should I stop it? And that's sometimes a difficult consultation.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And anything else non-antibiotic wise that you offer?
No, I don't think so. I think we've probably been through a lot of the things. I mean, I think just a word again on vaccines or immunoactive prophylaxis. I don't use it, mainly because I haven't got the regulatory approvals locally, but I understand there are some centres in the UK that are using them. And, you know, that should be in any discussion. So, you know, there's oral agents, which I think have probably got the best evidence base behind them in terms of number of studies. There's vaginal agents, slightly less effective if you look at the evidence side by side. But then there's this recent one, which is the sublingual vaccine, if you like. And that was recently, an RCT was recently published in one of the New England Journal kind of spin-offs. And that had patients who, like, more than 50% of them were UTI free at 12 months, which I thought was, you know, amazing results. So I think there's more to come with that, certainly. But, you know, the evidence base is growing, and it is strongly recommended by the EU guidelines, immunoactive prophylaxis. So it may well be that there's more to come in terms of the UK uptake of these kind of agents. So, yeah, I do talk about that. But I think other than that, there's not really a lot else to talk about. You're getting into antibiotics, prophylactic.
So we've managed to stave off the antibiotic chat quite successfully, haven't we? But I guess we ought to round off the discussion just by talking about antibiotics. So I presume that there still is a key role for antibiotics in terms of using them judiciously in selected patients.
Absolutely. I think, there has been a change in tone in guidelines. If you look at the latest EAU guideline, that tends to actually specify for the first time that daily prophylactic antibiotics should be used after non-antibiotics. So this is the kind of the first time we've ever seen the first sort of suggestion of a possible algorithm. Whereas you should always go non-antibiotic first. But you know, I would use antibiotics as a first line in patients who are getting very regular urinary tract infections, you know, those who are getting like monthly infections, I think, when you really want to get a hold. Because, you know, in terms of the numbers and UTI reductions and relative risk rates, there's still the best evidence comes from daily antibiotics. You know, you look at the Cochrane review, I think the average was about 0.2 in terms of the relative risk, which meant 80% of UTIs were prevented. And I think, you know, you talk about judicious use antibiotic stewardship is a big thing, and every medical practitioner should be following that. But NICE do give us a bit of a steer on it. And, you know, there are certain narrow spectrum antibiotics that we can use in the urinary tract that wouldn't really, wouldn't be too considered too broad spectrum. And, you know, they're just the ones NICE recommend, which are trimethoprim and nitrofurantoin. Trimethoprim resistance is an issue, I have to say. I would say maybe as much as one in three patients that I have failed trimethoprim because of the resistant organisms. But this is where, going back to the very start of the discussion, looking at previous cultures, what have they grown? Is it the same organism? Is it different? Is there evolving resistance? Things like that can be really important. So I think if you stick to a narrow spectrum antibiotic, and I would say nitro and trimethoprim would be my first line. My second lines would be cefalexin or fosfomycin. I have also had a bit of success with prophylactic pivmecillinam. So I use pivmecillinam 200 milligrams once a day. And that can be pretty useful.
How do you do the fosfomycin? Do they just have one sachet
once a week?
3 days?
No, once a week.
Okay.
So I give them 3 gram sachet once a week. I tend to make the regimes with fosfomycin a bit shorter than I would with antibiotics. I think with antibiotics, 6 months is probably the optimum kind of time you should use them. Although after ALTER, I'm now wondering if it should be longer, but NICE recommend that should be re-evaluated after 3 months. My personal view is that's a bit short, but I think 6 months. What was really interesting, if you look at the Cochrane review on prophylactic antibiotics, they talk about this relative risk, which is about 0.2, I think, when you're taking the antibiotics. But then they looked at it when patients stopped the antibiotics, and that relative risk goes up to 0.8, which means the majority of patients would relapse and have a breakthrough infection. We didn't find that in ALTA because, as you know, in ALTA we had an antibiotic arm, and we looked at patients not just for the duration they were on the prophylactic treatment, which was 12 months. We followed them for 6 months after that, and we didn't find a big rate of relapse in ALTA. And I don't know why that's so different. I can't really think of a plausible reason, but I think it's often worth telling patients. And this is something that is, again, I'm going from level one evidence to pure anecdote in a heartbeat here. But when patients finish prophylactic antibiotics, they very, very commonly will get what I call a rebound infection. I don't know why that is. They'll come off the antibiotics and they'll get an infection, but that might be the only one. So I tell them not to go back on the prophylaxis, just to treat it with a discrete course of treatment dose antibiotics, and then wait and see what happens. And a lot of them will not have a UTI again. So it's something about withdrawing the prophylaxis that maybe changes the gut flora and then the potential reservoirs for uropathogenic bacteria. But that is something that I do tell patients is, beware of the kind of rebound infection.
Do you cycle your prophylactic antibiotics?
No, I don't. I don't. I have to say.
Do you worry about those on nitro for kind of more than 3 months?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So just to go back to your first point, I think cycling of prophylactic antibiotics is, it's almost, if I wanted to breed up a resistant bacteria, I might give someone a different antibiotic and change it all the time. And there's good evidence, I think, from the ITU literature to show that for respiratory infections, you get more resistance if you cycle antibiotics. Mm. So I don't tend to do that. Again, there's not a strong evidence base for that decision, but I just don't tend to do it. And then you were asking about something else. What was the second thing?
Nitrite.
I think you've got to be... Yeah, so you just got to tell them about pulmonary fibrosis and about... hepatic dysfunction, and I think you've got to look out for that. I think LFTs are regularly monitored. Have to say, of the nitro patients in ALTA, we didn't see any great difference in the LFTs, and because we monitored them, because one of the things that I wanted to monitor with methenamine is whether or not it upset the liver function test, because prior to the trial, I'd had a couple of patients who'd had deranged LFTs when they started methenamine, but actually in the trial we didn't see that so much. And we did have, I think, one patient who had nitrofurantoin who had a very transient ALT rise, but that was all. And once a year I'll have a patient who will really get bad pulmonary fibrosis off prophylactic nitrofurantoin, and it's awful, because it's not terribly reversible. Neither is it progressive if you stop the nitrofurantoin, but you do have to make that link. I think most doctors are aware of that. But what once a year, I certainly see that, I would say, yeah.
Are they people that have been on it for a long time, or do you see it?
Not necessarily.
Is it just some people tend to respond in that
way?
Yeah,
I don't necessarily think it. I mean, it will have some kind of relationship with duration, I'm sure, but I don't, I don't tend to see it only in those who've taken it for an extended period. So there are patients who've taken it for, say, 6 months, and then they get these complications. But actually, if you look at the patients who are coming through the doors of a UTI clinic, I mean, there's some of them been on prophylactic antibiotics for years. I mean, you find is that the kids with reflux who come through having UTIs, adults, they've never stopped their nightly cephalexin. And, I had one woman who'd been taking it for like 15 years, and you think, goodness me, has anyone ever looked at you? But I think there's a lot more vigilance around that now. I think, a lot of GP practices have pharmacists, and, I'll very very regularly get letters from GP pharmacists saying, oh, I've got Mrs. So-and-so, she's been on prophylactic whatever for, you know, an extended period. Is it time we had a try? And it's always good to try them without, particularly if they've gone, say, I don't know, 3 to 6 months infection free, that's a good time to think about withdrawing the prophylaxis, because then you're getting all of the elements of the innate immune system have regenerated. So, you know, every time you get a UTI, you're going to shed GAG, you're going to shed, you know, outer layers of urothelium, and you know, the blood is going to be pretty inflammatory. But if you've got the patient's UTI free for a 3 to 6 month period, it's a very good time to then think, well, right, we'll see what happens if we withdraw.
And what about post-coital antibiotics?
Yeah, really useful. I think there are some women who can absolutely say that if they became celibate, they'd never get a UTI, because they've only ever had UTIs, you know, associated with intercourse. But given the fact that, you know, celibacy is not a great option for most young women, we do think about post-coital antibiotics. And I think that they really can be very useful. And they are recommended in the guidelines now, in the EU guidelines, I think.
And is there a group that you just give a stock of kind of stop-start antibiotics that only, like, yeah, the only thing that works for them is full treatment?
Yeah, so I think self-start antibiotics is really good. You've got to monitor them very closely, because I think it's important to ensure that their overall antibiotic consumption is not off the scale. So I think you've got to look at... So what I do is I tend to review them after 4 months and see how many times they've taken a self-start. But again, self-start antibiotics are now starting to appear in guidelines. So I think all of these, so I think what this has shown you is that this is why I don't follow algorithms for UTI, because there's so many options. And I think if you go into a case and you get the kind of individual nuances of the case, then you'll kind of get an idea. And you also get the patient's feeling towards, you know, what kind of preventative treatment they'll want, then that gives you an idea of, you know, what to concentrate your discussions on. And, you know, it's taken me, what, the best part of an hour now to talk about all the different options. So this is why specialist clinics are good. You know, we have a specialist clinic.
I was just going to say, I think one of the main points that comes across, Chris, is the huge benefits of having a dedicated UTI service staffed by experts. And I mean, I think a lot of these ladies do just pop up in general urology clinics, don't they? And they're managed very heterogeneously. And I mean, clearly we can't send all of them to you. I'd love to send all of mine to you. But I mean, you presumably cultivated a really good multidisciplinary team to deal with these ladies up in Newcastle.
Yeah, so, and that's not just on the clinical side. What I think has been the greatest addition is really interested scientists who want to do good, groundbreaking science. You know, I mean, we've talked about ALTA, and prior to that we had ANTIC from Newcastle. But, you know, as well as the clinical trials, there's some great basic science work going on. And so you do build up a bit of a network. I mean, your colleagues love you, because none of them really want to see, you know, swathes of recurrent UTI patients. So, you know, anyone who was thinking about setting up a UTI clinic, then, you know, that's the kind of way to go. And the you know, the benefit you can bring is, in, you know, if you look, like I said, you know, in our trial, we took women from 7 UTIs down to about 1.5 UTIs a year. And like that's life changing. So like you do get quite a lot out of it when you get it right. I mean, the difficulty comes with the patients who you know you do struggle with. Some of them are very refractory UTIs, and you know, when you get into a point of, you know, really quite major stuff, you know, you can imagine it's not unusual for me to hear a woman say, look, just take my bladder out, I can't live with my bladder anymore. But then, you know, you sometimes get a bit of joy doing it for sort of recurrent chronic urinary tract infections, but you know, you run the risk of just converting regular infective cystitis to a regular UTI, which is an ileal conduit, and that can be you know, that can be really a really difficult scenario.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. That was a hugely illuminating discussion, and I think we've covered most of the practical points that, you know, jobbing stone surgeons, for example, need to know about when seeing these patients. I say, I think I'll ask you off air at some point, Chris, about what you feel about recurrent UTIs and incidental small Kalesial stones, but I rather fear that we'd probably have another hour's worth of discussion about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we definitely need to get you back on the podcast at some point to talk about some other things. Just a final point: my microbiologist here in Nottingham, who I believe you know very well, Annie Joseph, is a huge fan of your
work. She's excellent.
She's had lots of discussions with you, and Annie, if you're listening, we'll get you on an episode as well, maybe with Chris at some point in the.
No, I think an hour's wisdom is great for me. Thank you very much. But it would be great to get you on again to discuss some of the more complex areas of it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, thank you both very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of FRCS Eurocast. Your hosts were Harry Rattan and Sophia Cashman, and our special guest was Professor Chris Harding from Newcastle. Feel free to contact us. The email is urologyresource@gmail.com, and we hope to catch you next time.